Welcome to the August 2017 edition of the Crossbox Podcast. I'm your host, John, with my co-host,
Jay. And this might end up being the September 1st edition, depending on how quick I am with the editing. But
we'll see. We recorded it in August, so yeah. Shut up, it's August.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
Yeah. But we've got a very fun episode for you tonight.
With lots of griping, actually.
Yeah, so it's going to be positively gripe-tacular.
Speaking of positive, though, we ought to get to the positivity first, so we can get that out of the way.
Exactly, and then it doesn't clog up our negativity later. You want to kick us off there, buddy?
Sure, I am. And the thing that I'm going to be positive about today is summer. And I suppose in particular this summer, but just generally the idea of summer. The long days, the warm evenings, traveling, shooting sports, outdoor theater, grilling, vacations, the whole nine yards. I'm just a big fan of the season in general.
And I thought camping.
Even camping. I do. I grew up camping. A lot of camping out of cars. We ate pretty well for, like, people camping. Our typical camping trip involved a giant cooler filled with ice in which we kept all of the wonderful proteins we would consume over the course of the weekend. There's mulligan stew, a lovely marinated chicken. Camping food, that's another underrated thing, provided it's not, like, backpacking food, because backpacking food is terrible.
Ah, Jay, nostalgic for his sea rations from his days in Da Nang.
I am, actually. That is awfully negative of me, so I will offer a way to make backpacking food a positive instead. You freeze a steak and wrap it in foil and put that in your pack, and by the time you get to where you're going on your first night, you have a steak that's pretty much defrosted, and you can cook it and have a steak while all your backpacking buddies are having, like, goop from a can.
Exactly. Perfect. Take that, sea rations.
So, yeah, steak. I'm also positive about steak.
Steak's a pretty easy thing to be positive. Even I can't snark about steak, frankly.
It's true, yeah.
I mean, unless you were to, like, horribly overcook it.
So what do you have for us? What are you going to be positive about?
I'm going to be positive about the joys of police trade-ins, which honestly feels like the gun guy version of adopting a pet, except if it wasn't a pet, but another gun. But I just bought a really nice, well, okay, nice on the inside, haha, police surplus Remington 870 shotgun. It's old. It has terrible finish. Like most police trade-ins, it was shoved in a rack a lot and shot very little. And there's nothing wrong with them. Just they like to trade them in for new stuff, and then they sell them to you. You get the leftovers, which is fine because those leftovers are at like a massive markup. So my 870 police
markdown.
Yeah, markdown. That's the one. Thank you. Markdown, the good one. My 870 police was about half the cost of a new one. Plus, I don't give money to evil Cerberus Freedom, whatever the hell they're called this week. The people who own Remington and killed their QC.
Yep.
And drove the brand into the ground. So I get one that is, you know, was built back when they built good guns. Plus, it's been maintained by an armorer with company training and official factory parts as opposed to Bubba parts. And so the innards are usually pretty good. So it'll be a fun project gun. I'm going to use it through a couple classes. It'll probably be a follow-on to my tactical pump shotgun post in terms of the let's test a lot of this stuff and play around with it. But yeah, police trade-ins, as long as you're not super picky about what you want, it's a great way to get pretty good guns at great prices.
And great prices are a thing we can both agree on.
Yep. Yeah, half off is a really good number.
It's almost like I'm the angel on your one shoulder that way, isn't it?
Right, yeah, telling me to be cheap. Except in this time, I actually was cheap.
Well, it's not like you ordinarily listen to me.
So no, but this time, this is the day when I do, because it's, I don't know, that episode in the TV show where the guy finally listens to the angel.
Hmm.
Yeah, no, it's a good day, and this is going to be fun. So, it should be a really good time. And again, there's a lot of good stuff out there if you look. The only downside is you're kind of at the mercy of whoever you, whatever you can find, whoever you're doing business with. We'll put a link in the description, but I went to Summit Gun Broker, which is not affiliated with the regular gun broker. They are different, and they have a ton of weird surplus stuff.
But John, their name's almost the same. How are they different?
Well, it's that almost part, that first word, and they have a space in gun broker. And they're full of, like, weird surplus stuff and new stuff, and it's just got all kinds of interesting things, and a lot of it is whatever he gets in, so it's a cool place to check back often. If you have a pawn shop, those will work sometimes. Some of the bigger gun stores have it. It's often a case of, like, knowing the right guy or looking in the right places.
Hmm.
But police trade in weapons. Awesome markdowns.
Well, double plus good, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that should be fun.
Well, I don't have anything police trade in, do I? Unless you count the Webley.
That's true. It is a police trade in.
It is a 1964, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Webley, I issued the Singapore Police Department back in, you know, the days when it was just freshly not a British colony anymore.
Right.
And probably the kind of place where you'd want a, you know, trusty sidearm.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. There's a lot of...
Or, if failing that, a Webley.
Yeah, something... Well, no, it's heavy, right? Bores the blade, heavy's good.
I suppose,
you can hit him over the head with it if it doesn't work.
I mean, somebody clearly did because the front sight blade is super bent.
Yep, yeah, somebody got buffaloed. Yeah. Or whatever. What would they say in Singapore instead of buffalo?
I don't know.
It's a question for some language expert who is not me.
Or an animal expert, somebody who knows what the, you know, native large land animal is. Oxend?
Yeah, what might charge you in Singapore and hit you upside the head?
Yeah.
Like a buffalo would if you were in, like, Wyoming circa 1840.
Anyway.
Anyway, yeah.
Tangent aside, I believe it is now time for the news.
That's right, it is.
And I believe the episode planning document has you going first.
That it does.
You have a topic for us?
I do indeed.
All right. Well, let me pull up the timer while I continue to talk slightly.
Today, I'm going to revisit yet again the modular handgun system, the gift that keeps on giving. Or perhaps the horse that just won't stay dead.
Hmm. Did we talk about that last month, or was that something you added to the document today?
Oh, nuts. I didn't add that to the document today.
No, that was what you talked about last month then.
Well, never mind. Quick audible then. Very well. Oh, we have a new topic that is not the modular handgun system. There was much rejoicing because John finally shut up about the damn thing. No, today I'm going to talk about the USS John McCain.
Ooh, that's a good one.
That it is.
That's right. We talked about that at work. How did you forget that so quickly?
Because it was in the planning document. Follow the plan, Jay, except when we deviate from the plan, which is now.
All right. Well, let me get the countdown queued up for you. In 3, 2, 1.
So, if you've been living under a rock, the John McCain hit or was hit by a freighter, possibly named the MV Giant Metaphor. In any case, there was discussions, because this is the fourth ship this year in the Seventh Fleet to hit something and get busted up, that maybe someone had hacked the McCain. And I'm here to tell you today that is absolute poppycock, balderdash, and all manner of other words to describe nonsense. Frankly, the McCain was not hacked. Hackers are the stupid things people like to trot out when there isn't really a good explanation, or, more likely, you don't want to say the real explanation. Training in the Seventh Fleet is in a horrible, miserable state. They have a ridiculously high op tempo, and something must be done. But that something is not panic about hackers in a closed network ship.
Well done. You hit your time really well there.
Beautiful. Yeah. All right, go me. But yeah, and also, this is kind of fun for us guys, because computer security is normally something Jay would talk about, and Jay's topic, atomics, is normally something that I would go crazy
about. Yes, indeed.
All right, Jay, so you ready over there with the timer? I'm going to count you down.
All right.
3, 2, 1, hit it.
All right, so my topic for today is the B-61 Mod 12. One of the most venerable nuclear bombs in service is getting a new edition. And this one's pretty sweet, I gotta say. I'm not usually a big atomic bomb kind of guy, but I can't argue with a variable yield and a JDAM kit. Now, granted, it is a nuclear gravity bomb, which is kind of the least formidable kind nowadays. And when I told John that I was super excited about this, he said, why not an air-launched cruise missile? And I guess, that makes sense, but you don't load up the gravity nukes on your strike eagles when you're attacking someone you're afraid of shooting you down. And I think you can probably solve that problem too if you were to put on a JSOW kit, say. And I mean, honestly, it's nice to see that we've got the nuclear industry still going strong. And, who can say no? Who can say no to 50 to 300 or however many kilotons of explosive glory?
I certainly can't.
Yeah.
Nor can Ripley, though Ripley would want to drop it from orbit.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it just seems like a super handy thing to have in your arsenal. A bomb you can dial way down.
Or way up.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the way down is more important as a... more important as a tactical capability.
I guess.
I feel like dialing it all the way up is something you wouldn't have to do very often with your gravity bomb. But the low-end capability is nice. In the event we find ourselves in a tactical nuclear war against North Korea, where China kind of gives us a little wink and says, you know, we won't stop you if you were to retaliate for the glassed southeastern corner of Seoul or whatever.
Right, right. See, I'm just having a hard time thinking of a time when I would open up the menu of nuclear options and not pick the, extra crispy options on the third page. But that might just be me, and that might just be because, you know, my doctrinally I'm kind of stuck in the 80s.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is, if there are if there is usage of atomics in the 21st century, it's either going to be some random guy with a briefcase spreading a bunch of plutonium over, downtown Paris or whatever. I know. But it's either going to be that, or it's probably going... well, either that or possibly an all-out war. But more likely, I feel like, is... North Korea and the Chinese not being all, we're going to blow all of you up if you blow up the North Koreans. Because I don't think China's that crazy.
No.
I think North Korea probably is that crazy.
They might be that crazy. They might be that crazy. Yeah. They just need to be a little radioactive.
Yeah. Did we ever talk about how... well, we talked about a couple of shows ago how Seoul's not in all that much danger and North Korea is kind of a paper tiger.
Right.
We kind of glossed over the issue of atomics then.
Right, yeah. But that's a separate topic.
Yeah.
And we need to get on to our next real topic, which is actually a nice movie topic that we could have segued into from the Ripley comment. Namely, sci-fi guns.
Oh, sorry,
much they suck.
I missed that cue. So.
We can fix it in post.
Well, we're not going to, but we could.
We could have fixed it in post. Part sound designer wasn't lazy. So movie guns and sci-fi video game guns are designed by... people who don't know what they're doing. People who don't really think about, like...
how would this gun be to use?
Right. Right.
I think we should...
Maybe... here's an idea. If I want to hit something with my gun, I might use the sights.
Yeah. I think let's open it up with something that everyone's going to be familiar with. Everyone who listens to this show, at least.
Sure.
That would be the blaster rifle from Star Wars.
All right. Yeah. The classic Stormtrooper blaster rifle.
I believe John said before the show it is the E-11 or E-11B, depending on the precise mark.
Yeah.
To which I gave him mad props for trivia knowledge.
Which is a Sterling submachine gun with a bunch of stuff glued on it.
I believe the term in the industry is Greedleys.
Sure. Whatever. Crap. And so now the Sterling submachine gun is not a bad submachine gun. It's a Sten that's much, much better because it has build quality.
A Sten that's much better is not a hard target to hit, though.
No. So it's a perfectly adequate 9mm submachine gun. But because this is the future, we use small magazines to fire blanks because they're quote-unquote power packs. And we put a scope on top because scopes are cool, and there's a bunch of other things because it's a blaster now. But a couple things you might notice. One, there's a stock on the Sterling. It's a folding stock that folds under the barrel. Do you know what the Stormtroopers never do?
Use it?
Yeah.
Well, see, you would be surprised if you were not familiar with the Sterling ahead of time to be told that there is a stock on the thing, because it just looks kind of like another random bit they welded on to make it look all futuristic.
Yeah, it's an angled foregrip before those were cool.
Yeah, but that little bit on the bottom, it folds underneath, and then the little back panel folds down and goes against your shoulder, and you can shoot it reasonably accurately. I mean, I've had some time on a Sterling, and they're a boatload of fun, and notably, you can, again, look through the sights and point them at a thing and then pull the trigger and be fairly likely to hit the thing.
Huh. Gee, what a concept.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's also that fancy scope that they glue on. The Stormtroopers bring nowhere in the proximity of their face.
You can picture the standard Stormtrooper riflery, like, posture, which is kind of like, you know, their weak foot forward and the gun kind of held... I guess if you were like to bring your backhand up from port arms, I guess.
Yeah.
Just kind of like held out in front of them, pointed vaguely in the direction they want. Not right. Braced anywhere, just holding the pistol grip with the, you know, the strong hand and the bottom of the fold-out stock with the weak hand.
Right. And the Sterling, you know, the body of it, the receiver, I guess, extends quite a bit behind where the pistol grip is. So if you weren't going to unfold the stock, there's something you could kind of brace against, you know, your shoulder or your bicep or even your hip if you're firing from the hip, as stormtroopers are wont to do. But they don't even do this.
Not in the slightest. It's just sad, really.
Yeah, just like kind of wave this in the direction of the target. Well, you know, it's like those people that think guns are a talisman to make bad things go away.
Yeah.
All right, so that's the stormtrooper blaster. That was, I mean, they look cool, but they're never terrible used guns. Right.
Let's march onward to the future of Star Wars.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
All right, well, first we have to drive 88 miles an hour in our DeLorean.
Yeah. Or just, you know, take the slow way. I suppose like we actually did.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, so we've got Captain Phasma's blaster rifle.
Yep.
Which at first glance isn't, you know, quite so bad. It does have a stock.
Yeah, they put a stock on it. Score.
Yeah, they listen to us in the future and the past.
Yeah, yeah. They totally listened to our future podcast telling them they were wrong and said, aha, we totally glued some Magpul stuff on the back of this. Take that.
And it does kind of have that sort of Magpul look, although somehow it does seem to, like the look of it looks like it has a folding stock on the front too.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, two stocks are better than one, right?
Oh, exactly, yeah.
I mean, and if you're never good
that way you can shoot it backwards.
Exactly. And I mean, I guess like that bottom one doesn't count because nobody ever unfolds it.
Mm-hmm.
Or something. But yeah, two stocks is brilliant. Also, I think it's probably like an off-brand Magpul.
It is, yeah. It is actually like a usable looking gun, though. Much more
right.
so than it.
There's some progress there.
Yeah.
Though we never see Phasma shoot it, so we can't actually critique her or praise her on whether or not she actually looks
uses the scope. Right. There's a scope mounted more or less where you'd expect one to be.
Right,
like
yeah.
It even looks like a kind of like a modern, you know, smallish tube
right,
1-6 rifle scope.
So, you know, the question is going to be, does Phasma, which we hope to answer in the next movie, does Phasma know how to use her rifle, or would Michelle Rodriguez in space totally kick her ass?
Yes.
My money is on Michelle after watching her shred at Taron Butler's place.
That's probably a safe bet.
Yeah.
Now.
Actually, wait, one more Star Wars weapon going back.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, let's go back to episode one. Not terrible, because they actually put what looks like a target pistol grip, or more precisely, built it off of a target pistol. But the Naboo guard blasters, the S5s or whatever they're called, have about four scopes on them. And it really looks like somebody spent entirely too much time dragging the gun through a TAPCO catalog.
Yeah, but again, it's not terrible. It's another one that you could actually use.
Right, as long as you pick, as long as one of those scopes is sighted in, preferably the one on top, because that's the one placed in the least stupid position. Yeah.
Got to hold it kind of upside down and diagonal.
Right, right.
You know, the barrel at 7 o'clock compared to your hand. And,
yeah, that's perfect.
Very gangster.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Jerry Michalik could still totally shoot awesome with it, but the rest of us are going to buy a normal gun.
Well, let's move onward to the other big science fiction franchise.
Stargate?
The other big... I said the other big science fiction franchise.
Oh, right. Yeah, Stargate's that big.
Yeah.
Star Trek!
Yep. We're going to start off with that classic, the Next Generation phaser pistol.
That's not really a pistol.
Yeah.
It's a phaser.
Now, see, I understand what they were trying to do. They were trying to make it, you know, not look like a gun, because that's not what Starfleet does. And then, of course, they proceed to use it, like, every episode as a gun to shoot the bad guys.
Because that's what you do when you have somebody trying to, like, murder Picard and eat his face.
Exactly.
You probably want to shoot that.
So let's... It's like a little kind of handheld dustbuster almost, right?
It really is. It's a dustbuster. It's a janky-looking dustbuster with some... What was that word you said?
Greeblies?
Yeah, those things. Some greebly things glued on it. And
so, you've got, it's basically kind of like a dustbuster handle that kind of kinks forward, and it's got some buttons on top that do various things. Also, that seems like an ergonomics, or like a usability nightmare. I see five buttons on this thing.
Yep.
You're going to hit the right one of those during combat. Don't tell me you think that's actually the case.
No. The other great thing, of course, is that, you know, so a pistol is pretty intuitive to aim, at least in the general direction of the target.
Yeah.
The dustbuster isn't. And if you watch Star Trek, you know, carefully, you can often see places where production designers kind of bent the beam more than you might otherwise expect a beam to be able to be bent, so that the character actually hits what he's supposed to be.
Doesn't have to take run another take of that of that scene 3 months later.
This is good, so we're just gonna like pencil this in, and you know, Riker's magical bending phaser. Or do you know what they could do instead?
What?
They could have a pistol, and then they could put sights on it, and then they could use those sights.
They could do that, but it seems very unlikely they actually would.
Yeah, or honestly, you know, the original series, which had actual pistol-looking things, probably because Gene Roddenberry was in the Navy and knew that guns could be good and helpful, those were pistol-looking, and Kirk and Spock did a pretty good job in pointing it enough at the target so that the phaser didn't have to, you know, do a 180.
You know, I'm even thinking, like, Galaxy Quest, that that lovely Star Trek parody had pistol-shaped things.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, ray guns, you know, the Star Trek, the movies with Kirk with the cool uniform, the cool red uniforms, they had some pretty nifty little pistol things.
I mean, generally speaking, Galaxy Quest did a pretty good job, except for the lack of sights on the big rifle things, or the lack of sights generally, but that's kind of a movie
conceit, I feel like. But, I mean, you know, okay, you can at least point shoot with the Galaxy Quest guns. You can't point shoot with a dust buster.
Well, what you need is like a continuous beam phaser so you can walk it onto the target.
There you go, just get a fire hose.
Yep.
Burn holes in, like, everybody in the ship. It'll be good.
All right, so next up, we have something going even further forward into the future of Star Trek, which I'll let you introduce.
All right, so Star Trek Voyager had basically the same Dustbuster things as on The Next Generation, except with a slightly different shape, because it's a different show. But, of course, every so often, we decide that we need a bigger, badder ray gun, so we break out the compression rifle, which is quite possibly the ugliest gun we're going to be talking about on this show today.
Or maybe ever.
Or ever, yeah. I don't think we're going to be able to top this thing. It has all of the fails. It has a weird California-compliant, not pistol grip. You know, before that was a thing they had to worry about.
We'll put a link to a picture in the show description so you can tell what we're talking about.
Yep.
I suppose I should put links to all these pictures. That would make a lot of sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we're going to link all the pictures. So it's got a not pistol grip that's California-compliant, because that's going to be fun to hold. It has a not stock, but an extension that is going to be way too short to use like a stock.
And also tiny. So I do recall it kind of moved around a lot under firing. And
wait, I can't imagine why.
Yeah.
Maybe because there's no third point of contact?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, I want to talk about the California-compliant pistol grip again, because that's just... it bothers me. on a fundamental level, it's just the worst idea in stock manufacturing I could think of. And they went and made it a real thing.
Yep.
So what we're talking about, in California, you're not allowed to have a pistol grip. That means no kind of standard pistol grip, obviously, no thumb hole stock, because that's still a pistol grip. You can get your thumb around it.
That's exactly it. That's how they define pistol grip, quote unquote, is you can get your thumb around the back.
Yeah. So what they've done is the AR manufacturers nowadays have these little pistol grips that have fins behind them. So you can hold them with the front of your hand, but you can't. Your thumb has to kind of lie up along the side of the fin. It can't wrap around the gun. And, I mean, I just don't understand.
Right. It's terrible. And see, they're doing it to be legally compliant with the ridiculous state of California gun laws.
But do you know what else is California compliant? Something in the format of, like, I don't know, Mini
Durant.
30. Yeah.
Yeah, except the Mini 30 is a piece of junk.
Well, yeah, but they're something in the same form factor. Like a, you know, as large capacity as you're allowed to have in California, magazine-fed rifle that just looks like a ranch gun. And they haven't quite worked out a way to ban those yet without banning everything, so.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But, yeah, so this thing is goofy. It has a light on top, but nothing that is even remotely resembling sights, which is good because nobody aims with it. And it's a really nice forward angled pistol grip thing. But the back one, as we've said, is completely stupid. And if you look at all of the pictures I've seen of the props, there are zero controls on it of any kind.
There's kind of like a button there on the side of the thing you might press with your thumb for a trigger.
Maybe. Okay, maybe there's one control on it. It's just terrible.
But yeah, if it is a trigger, it's not where you'd expect a trigger to be, and it can't be actuated by your trigger finger. It must be actuated by your thumb, which, as we've noted, is laying up alongside the pistol grip in the most awkward place possible.
Yeah, this is just a bad idea all around. You look at it and you go, that can't possibly make sense. And it doesn't. It doesn't look cool. The gun is fat and ugly and stupid. And it's just too stupid to have a good time. Let's move on. I'm done with this thing.
All right. Well, that does wrap up our Star Trek thing. And now that we've slain two sacred cows, let's move on to a third.
All right, Halo. Well, you know, I'm pretty hungry for some beef, yeah.
So yeah, Halo. I guess it's not terrible as far as guns go. I mean, it could be worse as far as guns go.
Yeah.
But let's look at two classics. You've got the pistol, the classic Halo pistol.
The M6B?
Yes, the M6G, I believe.
Oh, G now? Whatever.
Or I might just be looking at the, you know, the wrong
thing. Either
but
way.
They all look roughly the same.
The M6 pistol, yeah.
Yeah. So, it's just, I don't even know where to start.
So,
you've got roughly a pistol shape.
Yep.
It's got a enormous sort of beaver tail thing, and the slide rides on top of that.
Yeah. It has a really short barrel.
And then up at the front, you have this weird hump thing that appears to be bolted onto the gun. So presumably that's some sort of sighting device.
Yeah.
But of course, what it does is blocks the iron sight. So if your sighting device fails, you can't actually use it.
Right.
I suppose the traditional method of aiming in Halo is even the Marines have those little eyepiece HUD glass things, which I suppose that's nice, but it seems awfully fragile.
Those aren't very confidence-inspiring. But, I mean, the Marines are only there to, like, die to prove the situation is serious.
Yeah. And I guess you've got this enormous D-shaped pistol grip. You can fit your trigger guard. You can fit your whole hand inside. And I guess maybe that's for the benefit of the Spartans. But the pistol predates them. And there's only one now anyway. So presumably they would make one that, I don't know, makes more sense for a standard human person.
Yeah. I just can't get over the proportions of the thing. When have you ever seen... It's like...
It reminds me of the Borchert, actually.
Yes, that's exactly it. Except, like, cut down.
Yeah, cut down on both ends.
Right.
Oh, and the best part is, if you look at the back of it, it clearly has, like, a rear iron sight block on the slide.
Right.
Just there's no way to use the front sight.
And if you were going to have, like, an optical doodad that's going to block... Excuse me, Greebly, that's going to block the sights, you might just, you know, remove the back one.
Yeah. Well, see, what I'm curious is about, like, the sighting unit looks like it bolts to the top of the barrel assembly. Like, bolts to the frame in front of the slide, since the slide is at the very back in kind of classic old-timey gun fashion.
Yeah.
Why not just bolt it to the bottom of the frame? Then you can use the iron sights and you still have the benefit of your fancy super soldier aiming system.
Yeah, I have no idea, because, I mean, presumably that's some kind of camera dealio, right?
So, yeah, something to index the gun so the HUD reticle can follow it.
Right, yeah. So, but it doesn't really matter where that is as long as it's somewhere on the gun.
Yeah. Well, maybe slaying that one. So let's move on to the assault rifle, which in...
MA5 something something?
5B or 5C, yes.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Wow, I'm doing well with these.
Yep. So this one, again, is, like, it's not terrible, but it's got some weird features to it.
Yeah. Yeah,
so picture like one of those Kel-Tec carbines, maybe?
Right, picture an F-2000.
Yeah.
It's an F-2000, but they only saw one picture of it, and they had no understanding of how it actually worked. So they just kind of tweaked the picture and called it a day.
So let's go from back to front, because I think that's the most surprising way to handle it.
Yeah, the back to front is lots of fun.
Yeah, so at the back you have a nice, but looks like a padded stock almost. That's kind of nice.
And you got a magazine. It's clearly a bullpup.
Just a little bit forward, like the magazine's right there.
Mm-hmm.
Forward of that is the ejection port somehow. So we were speculating how that might work, and I think the only way we can make it happen is either the bolt goes out over your shoulder, or it's articulated and goes down into the back of
the bolt go into a shoulder thing that goes up?
Ooh, that would make an assault weapon.
Senator Feinstein, I found your other assault weapon.
It is a shoulder thing that could go into a shoulder thing that goes up.
Right. It could also be some kind of weird, like, articulated centipede-like doodad that kind of folds.
Slides downward somehow.
Yeah, curls up.
Maybe it's like a toggle lock.
Yeah, that's it. There's a toggle on top of it.
Yeah.
For, like, the galaxy's biggest toggle.
Yeah. So, moving slightly forward, you have a thumb hole, which is pretty great compared to things we've seen before. You can actually put your thumb inside the... like around the back of the pistol grip, like you're supposed to. I don't see a trigger on this side view.
That's okay. We don't need triggers.
Clearly, we can shoot
with our mind.
It's mind actuated.
Yep.
So now we've got like a fairly normal looking gun with a couple of weird features. Granted, but it's science fiction people designing a gun. Yeah, this is not bad. And then you get to the front. You've got this gigantic, like what looks like a either metal painted plastic or metal. what's it, like a fore end, I guess. You've got a hand grip thing. And then a big wrapping hump thing around the front. And you think, oh, I can put like a red dot or something integrated into that hump. That's right by your eye. It's perfect. But no, that's the bullet counter.
On the actual F2000, the giant hump thing is in fact a glorified plastic cover for an optical sight.
Oh, there you go.
See? So the Belgians, right, so the F2000, if you look at it, has a forward ejection thing, so there's no ejection port to copy, so Bungie just penciled one in. It's 5.56, and Bungie clearly thought that magazine wasn't big enough, so they just made it bigger without thinking about what the space behind the magazine is for. And my guess is they just kind of looked at the hump thing and said, cool, and then left it, and didn't actually look at a back view of the gun.
It does seem to have two
yes.
barrels, almost.
Yeah,
well.
I think the bottom thing is a flashlight.
Ah, okay.
Because that giant grenade launcher thing, you're all like, oh, cool. On the F2000 has a grenade launcher, right? No, this is a flashlight.
The funny thing is there are pictures of grenade launcher attachments on the Halo Assault Rifle
mm-hmm.
that go over the flashlight.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Just crush the flashlight. You don't need it.
Yeah. All
right, also, why do you have a flashlight? That's like maglite size. This is the future.
Well, it's a really bright flashlight.
You know...
If you put a focusing lens on it, it doubles as an energy weapon.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, I guess that's clearly the answer, right, LAPD? Oh, my God. It really reminds me of one of the old 90s pictures of an M16, because that's what they had back then. M16, not M4s, kids, with a 3D-cell maglite. Hopefully the kids know what D-cells are.
Hmm.
And you attach that to the hand grip on your M16A2 with hose clamps. That's how they roll.
And then you drop it over the barricade because it's suddenly like 8 pounds heavier in the front.
Exactly. On the plus side, the maglites do make a really wonderful contact weapon.
Yeah. Well, you've got so when you drop, like when you're stuck picking it back up, you can just slide the maglite out of the hose clamps and then whack somebody with it.
Or when the hose clamps inevitably like fail because you adjusted them wrong or broke the plastic bit, you know, you can at least beat a man pretty good with that.
Yeah.
I think they're actually prohibited now from carrying them precisely because the people kept using them as bludgeons.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a big, heavy aluminum tube. It's perfect for it.
Yep. Well, speaking of big aluminum tubes.
Nice.
Yeah. So, nice. I suppose that might put you in mind of planes, but we're actually talking about something a little different and a little bit more futuristic. And for games, I will let John open this up.
Okay. So this one was actually brought up by a sale on the PlayStation Store. But I saw in there for, like, cheap, was Star Wars Jedi Starfighter, which, of course, was a game that ties into Attack of the Clones in our sci-fi theme tonight. And it was a game that I'd always wanted as a kid, but had never got for whatever reason. So I said, all right, well, let's rectify this. Let's buy this thing. So I did, and I love a good spaceflight game, and I love flight sims, and so perfect, right? And the game starts off really cool. You have some force powers in a Jedi Starfighter and some other bomber thing with lots of bombs and plenty of lasers, and the game starts really cool. It's lots of fun. It felt like a, you know, off-brand Rogue Squadron ripoff.
Yeah.
So, you know, fun, right? And then all of a sudden you get to this one point and the difficulty curve just goes into the vertical, and you're stuck with these weird missions where you basically have to play through enough to memorize the mission so you can queue off all of the timed events so that you or the thing you're trying to protect, God help me, doesn't die. Because you have to know, oh, things are going to come in from hyperspace here and here, and I send my wingmen to attack that because that's the only way I can get to this other guy before he destroys the target, and my wingmen are useless, but they might damage that thing, and then I can zip over and kill the thing my wingmen delayed. And it just becomes very unfun.
Yeah, see, I played the first couple of levels, the tutorial levels, and then the first level or two of actual gameplay. And I kind of had the same initial impression John did. It seemed like a fun little game, although I did, you know, I did not like the lack of cockpit view.
Yeah.
You are
very arcade-y.
You are in first person, but all you have is a head-up display, despite the fact that in the cutscenes you can clearly see that you are sitting in the cockpit of a starfighter, at least in the case of the Jedi.
Yeah, now you can. Well, you can't really see into the bomber, but you're clearly talking from in the bomber.
Yeah. Well, and even if you had screens, you'd expect it to be a little bit different than that. Anyway, but I then watched some videos of later on in the game, and it just seemed like it took a weird turn.
Yep.
There is a zoom feature, and all the fancy players were using the zoom feature, you know, basically all the time to make super long shots on things. So they didn't have to fly all the way over to them, so they could then turn around and shoot the thing that was coming at them from the other direction, and so on and so forth. All kinds of missiles flying everywhere in various murdery ways.
Yep. The missiles are pretty horrible. The zoom feature is required because unlike in, say, Rogue Squadron, or any actually good flight sim, space or not, where you have to protect the thing, it's like they screwed up on or didn't test the timers on everything or the damage rates and spawn timing because you don't have enough time to engage things normally and deal with them. You have to do these long-range sniping things to kill things to pick them off before they get to the target because then they'll kill it. You won't have enough time.
Yeah.
And it, whereas in something like Rogue Squadron where you don't have the stupid zoom feature. What is that anyway? Zoom.
Yeah, that's one of my big quibbles with the game design, actually, because it kind of... Well, that and the unlimited ammo and the lasers that don't stop after N distance.
Right.
Because it really encourages just kind of sitting in a convenient spot.
Right.
And spamming away at everything until it dies.
And then to deal with that, you come up with gameplay mechanics that require you to sit in one spot and spam things. Because otherwise, the mechanics designed to punish this behavior will kill everything for you. So in something like Rogue Squadron, the timers are set up such that it takes, you know, so, okay, Rogue Squadron Mission 3, search for the Nona. There are a number of things trying to kill this wrecked freighter and the shuttle evacuating the crew. But you have plenty of time to fly around normally and kill everything. And it's actually kind of hard until the bombers show up and you're several waves into the bombers for you to die, for you to fail, because the shuttle blew up. Everything is set up so it takes some time so you can fight it normally and you're not assumed to be perfect. It's like Factor 5? Yeah, Factor 5 actually playtested the damn thing and said, oh, gee, you know, if we have people who aren't experts playing this, they're going to need to take some runs to kill the AT-ST or whatever. So we're going to set this up and the shuttle can take some punishment.
Yeah.
As opposed to, well, you're protecting this big fat transport and it's getting jumped by, you know, fighters and missile frigates and, you know, God forbid, these little Geonos and missile spam bots.
I didn't play enough of the game to get a sense for it the way that John has. But I think the critiques that I have are the ones that, like, they're kind of easy to work out in those first couple of moments. So, number one, I've already mentioned the lack of a cockpit view. And I think that's a very important thing that you need to have in your flying games if you're going to be inside of a ship to make the experience feel real. One of the things that Elite Dangerous, one of the most atmospheric space games of recent memory, does really well is it makes you feel like you're in the cockpit of a spaceship.
Yep.
All of your menus are little holographic pop-ups. You kind of look to the side with your track IR and suddenly they pop up right there. You use your HOTAS controls to put the cursor where you want it and you press a button. You're in a spaceship. It's pretty great. When you don't have the cockpit around you, even like a non-interactive one, like, say, an X-Wing Alliance, you don't feel like you're in a ship. You're just in a... you're just kind of a disembodied head floating around. And Rogue Squadron gets around that by being a third-person game, which I think
it
is...
It did have a cockpit view.
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
Well, there you
go. Just have to, like, select it. Defaulted to a third-person perspective.
Yeah.
Which isn't bad.
I think it's fair to call it primarily a third-person game, and I don't think that's a bad thing.
No.
Yeah. It kind of lets you pull off more incredible feats of flying, because you can actually see the extent of your vessel much better.
Right, and you can get that feel for the ship, which you don't have at all in something like floating head game.
Yeah, and let's also talk about capital ships, because capital ships in Jedi Starfighter look obnoxious.
They are obnoxious. Yeah. They just... Annoyingly, so there's two ships, and there's the bomber thing with a bunch of different exotic weapons, because it doesn't have force powers, and then the Jedi Starfighter where you have force powers, which you don't run out of, they're just on a timer, which is kind of a weird mechanic. Anyway, none of your force powers are really super good against capital ships. What you end up doing is using the Matrix Time force power to let you spam the capital ship with guns, and then hope the capital ship doesn't, like, beat on you with its own guns.
Yeah, and it just kind of sounds and looks silly, honestly.
It's not satisfying. It's not cool. Yeah.
Again, compared with something like, say, X-Wing Alliance,
right,
where your capital ships are modeled down to a bunch of different systems that you can sub-target, you can do that thing where you fly up to the shield generators and blow them up in classic fashion.
Right. And you generally can... in X-Wing Alliance, the capital ships are either set pieces or things that are being fought by your own capital ship.
Yeah.
Both.
Or so, say like things that you're, I guess the set pieces, like you're flying in with your group of bombers and mm-hmm. you're going to release torpedoes all at once. They can't shoot them all down on the way in.
Right. Yeah. We're going to bomb that big capital ship there, you know, but like Sink the Tirpitz, it's really just a, you know, it's functionally a set piece. It's not something that you alone are tasked to kill.
Right.
And I'm sure someone's going to chime in with Jedi Starfighter does have subsystem targeting, except that it's terrible and it's extremely limited and there aren't very many subsystems.
That and it's finicky, I felt like.
Like we said, it's terrible. Yeah. It doesn't really work the way X-Wing Alliance did, where you could just target a thing and cycle through whatever.
It's various sub-items.
Right. Or going back to Rogue Squadron 2, where they added capital ships... there's no subsystem targeting, but it's pretty easy to see. Well, that's a gun turret. I can shoot it. That's a shield generator. I can shoot that, too.
Yeah.
So that was... Yeah, and then the things blow up, and hey, look, it's shooting at me a lot less.
Haha, I've done something. I've made progress.
Yeah, exactly. Rogue Squadron 2, which was a couple years before Jedi Starfighter, actually did a really good job with making a Star Destroyer feel like a Star Destroyer, a giant mile-long battleship packed with guns. And it's got... Oh, I never bothered to count, but probably a good, you know, couple hundred or so little guns all trying to shoot at you and your buddies and anything else that moves.
Mm-hmm.
And if you fly straight and don't have buddies around, it will kill you pretty quickly because they'll just keep hitting you.
Yeah.
So you have to maneuver and you have to fly with your buddies or get them to attack the guns to distract some. And it's pretty cool. And it feels like, you know, hey, that looks like a giant, scary capital ship. As opposed to this, where the capital ships in late game, spoiler alert, have like 10 turrets.
Well, 10 turrets and...
most of them are huge.
That and gigantic health bars, too.
Yeah.
You've got to like slowly, slowly chip away at, even with your fancy bomber weapons.
Yep.
Yeah.
Boring, right? And again, Rogue Squadron, when you kill the destroyer in the Razor Rendezvous level, you destroy critical subsystems. You have to destroy the shield generators and then the bridge.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't have to chip away slowly and boringly at all of the thing's massive health bar.
I think what we're saying is you ought to be playing X-Wing Alliance or Rogue Squadron instead of Jedi Starfighter.
Or TIE Fighter. That's another good one.
Your various PC X-Wing series games.
Yep. Yeah. Really, the only console Star Wars flying game that's worth money is the Rogue Squadron games.
And you can get those on PC.
The first one, at least. You can't get two on PC.
Oh, I didn't realize. Yeah. Wasn't there a three?
There is a three. It's less good.
Okay.
And of course I'm not gonna, you could of course try to emulate GameCube with the Dolphin Project, but in
terms which
of
is official, much better now.
Yeah, it is. It's very improved.
Ooh, we should share that article about the texture whatever stuff.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. Anyway, so on PC there is Rogue Squadron on good old games, along with TIE Fighter, X-Wing Alliance, also the original X-Wing, but that one's old school hard, so don't say we didn't warn you.
Yes.
I think there's permadeath, if I remember correctly, in X-Wing.
I don't recall offhand, but
anyway,
it seems the kind of thing they'd do.
TIE Fighter is much better. X-Wing Alliance is very good. Rogue Squadron 3D is very good. And all of those are going to give you a flying starship fix pretty solidly. The other game, of course, I think I've mentioned it here before, Free Space and Free Space 2 are also not Star Wars, but they feel like they were trying to make a Star Wars game in all but name and give you excellent space flight mechanics. While being arcadey and, you know, not also a space trucking game.
Yeah.
So, basically, buy those instead. The nostalgia trip in Jedi Starfighter really isn't worth it.
And it is a nostalgia trip to the prequels, too. So,
yeah,
you can do better.
Like, really, really, I just, you know...
There were better movies in the series that you can go and find your way back to.
There's a couple cool things, but the prequels overall really not worth... Good soundtrack.
It is kind of a shame too, because one of the cooler things in the prequels was in fact that like Jedi Starfighter scene at the beginning of episode 3.
Yeah. Or that was a really cool battle, but nobody really did that justice in a video game.
Mm-hmm.
Also the Obi-Wan Jango Fett fight in the asteroid field, also really cool, also done justice by exactly no one.
Yep.
Sigh.
It's a shame that people just aren't making the same kind of space games they used to. And
nope.
I wish they would.
Yeah, see the death of, you know, arcade flying games in general.
Yeah.
Sad. But let's talk about something that's new.
And yes.
Possibly awesome. And very not dead.
Yes.
Let's talk about pistol red dots.
Pistol red dots.
And specifically, disclaimer here, we're talking about slide-mounted red dots rather than giant open gun type setups, though I do love those and they're awesome.
I'm sure he's going to have here. I'm sure John's going to have something to say about those next year. A little spoiler there for our long-term listeners.
Spoiler alert, this is going to get even louder and more awesome.
Yep.
But no, we're talking about the kind of red dot that you can mount on a normal, relatively cheap, modern handgun. You know, a commercial, you know, simple, regular, commodity, factory-made gun.
Yeah.
It might come from the factory ready for this. And these are the kind of things that you could shoot in carry optics or possibly concealed carry or maybe just take to a fun day on the range.
Yeah.
So let's talk about our ration. Like, why are we testing this, Jay? What are we doing here? I've already bought, like, four of the damn things.
Well, we've established that they're pretty cool, I think. Yeah. Me through shooting them, John through shooting them a lot, and also teaching new shooters to shoot with them.
Yeah.
They solve a lot of the problems you have with lining up your pistol sights because there's nothing to line up. You just put the dot on the target and pull the trigger.
Yep.
Now, there are some, maybe some caveats to that, I guess. Some things you, like some things the user must be aware of. And that is that your kind of standard press out technique probably won't work anymore unless you've got really high suppressors, like suppressor ready sights you can co-index with.
Yeah.
Because the way, at least the way I bring a gun up to my eye to sight is that I kind of bring it up nose first so I can watch that front sight in between the two, like into the rear notch. And if you've got just a dot in a window that you can't see, if it's not lined up more or less right, then you can't do that.
Right. Let's also point out, someone's going to say, why not watch the suppressor eye irons, then transition to the dot? That kind of defeats the purpose of the dot.
Right, because you're at that point, you're focused on the front sight, and then,
right.
Oh, I can shoot now. I have no need to focus on the target anymore. I can see the
exactly.
Thing.
Yeah. And shoot like one normally would. So I guess what we've discovered is that there's a couple extremes where they make sense. For a rank beginner shooter, they solve a lot of problems. Basically saying, put the dot on what you want to hit and pull the trigger. Right, and then I just have to talk trigger control was really nice, and I didn't have to talk about sight alignment and post and notch and what you focus on, equal height, equal light, and focus on the sight, not the thing you want to shoot.
Yeah.
And when you start talking about defensive applications, this gets even more, or, you know, movement or any of those competition applications, this starts to get annoying because especially defensive is probably the biggest one, right?
Yeah.
There's a big scary thing over there. Why am I not focusing on, like, the giant rapist with a machete?
Exactly. So the thing that a red dot does for you is it simplifies a lot of shooting problems.
That's right. And the other thing we know, so we know that that's that like for a shooter with not a lot of experience made things much easier for him. There's an article where I talked about that in our archives.
Which we will find and then link.
Yep. We also know that clearly if you spend time with them, you can get awesome with them. There's lots of, you know, competition shooters who shoot carry optics very well.
Yeah. But that's true of most things though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That really doesn't tell you much because, you know, okay, so at the high level, if you put in the time, you get pretty good with them. And also there's things about competition which may stress the wrong things. Often in competition you'll have silly targets, right? You'll have really small popper plates, you'll have things like 70 yards away or something, really targets to separate the men from the boys or something like that.
I think the activated targets too, I think.
Oh yeah.
Which are fun but not really a good training tool.
No, I mean, they train some things, but yeah, so, and again, a lot of these things would put the stress on, say, a red dot. You know, again, the advantages of the red dot, the range advantages, and the difficult target advantages brings a lot to the table in the competition setting where, you know what, I'll just train around. How many draws do I do in a USPSA match? One per stage, you know,
yeah.
Who cares? Right, if that's the point, everyone is slow, you know, I'll practice it and call it good, and then look at me, I'll just, you know, clean the plate rack at 100 yards.
Exactly.
So, you know, so clearly there's certain places where, and those people can also make that decision for themselves,
mm-hmm.
You know,
well, you pick a division you want to compete in and then you
yep.
build the gun for that division.
That's right. So let's talk somewhere in the middle, right? We have shooters who have some experience, probably, you know, it's a solid amount of experience with irons. You know what you're doing more or less, you know, you ain't Jerry Mitchellick, but you're good. You can shoot. We wanted to see, what about you guys? Does it make sense to spend the money and do the practice to get that? Basically, you have to fix your index on the draw, more or less.
Yeah.
Does it make sense to do that practice to get to the result?
Yeah. And so what we did was we designed an experiment to test this. We took several of John's guns to the range, some with and some without red dots. As well as my, I suppose, my PO9 and 40. Yep. And we came up with a little course of fire where we would each shoot five rounds. Well, five strings of five rounds with each gun at each caliber. But what we did not think of was that we actually didn't bring enough ammunition for that. So our experimental results are basically out the window.
Yeah.
I believe we each shot with the... We both shot with the non-dotted Glock first, right?
Right.
Yeah, and then we realized we were almost out, so we each took... Like, I think I took two strings with the red dot Glock, and John took one.
Right.
And we tried to make it a little bit more even with the 40s.
But we didn't get much results there. And it was really kind of a mess. And the other... So, problems we noticed, other than we can't count, we also discovered that our course of fire really should have been scored. We just gave ourselves a target and said, you know, hit the target and try to keep things in whatever ring or whatever. Yeah. But the problem there is that the sighting starts to become not relevant. It was 7 yards, but without, like, a scored target, there's not much incentive if you throw one out of the 8 ring or whatever.
Yeah, a man-sized target at 7 yards, that's basically still point shooting range.
Right. Yeah,
especially once you've gotten the gun lined up, once you've gotten a good sight picture and pulled the trigger that first time, then it's just the slide has come back, I can see the front sight on the target again, I'm going to pull the trigger again.
Right. And our grips aren't that bad. So, you know, you're going to get something in the man-sized target, and that's good enough. So the question of reacquiring the dot versus reacquiring the iron sights kind of gone.
Didn't come up, really,
right.
Yeah.
Because that was right, again, because you can always push the speed faster and, you know, cycle, you know, basically goes not quite cyclic, but, you know, close to cyclic. And you're really not punished for it because we're not keeping score.
Yeah.
So that was a problem.
So that was our one problem. Our other problem was running out of ammunition and not actually getting an accurate read on the situation. Because we wanted to do five strings each, our string being draw and shoot five. To get a good balance between the draw, which is obviously the slower part, and the reacquisition, which happens much faster.
Right.
And given that we wanted to do those five strings, we could, say, throw out the bad one.
Right, yeah, or average.
Or throw out the good one, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. We could play. That's some data we can play a little bit.
For statistics, right? And then we didn't have that.
Right.
We did notice a couple of things, though. Yeah. And you should take this with as many grains of salt as you can readily lay your hands on.
Yeah, this is pretty feelings heavily, and I hate feelings, and they tend to lie.
So as our relatively experienced shooter who nevertheless does not do much with pistol red dots, I found that, I think, generally speaking, I wasn't very much slower with equivalent guns with a red dot without doing much in the way of practice at all. And that was a little bit surprising to me, because acquiring that dot is not trivial if you haven't designed your kinematics to do that for you.
Right. And also, this was, you know, we're also kind of screwing with your kinematics, because you've mentioned you're a little sensitive to grip angle, and we had a Glock 17 with and a Glock 17 without a red dot as two of our test pistols.
Yeah.
So you're doing yourself no favors with either.
Right, but you'd hope that kind of averages out.
We'd hope so.
Yeah.
I kind of liked it as, you know, reinforcing the test quite a bit.
Yeah.
So
What we'll do again sometime is we'll take that pair of Glocks, the Glock 17 without the red dot and the Glock 17 with the red dot, up to the range. We'll bring enough ammunition this time to actually do our five rounds, five times course of fire, each of us.
Yep.
And we'll bring back results either for a future podcast episode or possibly an article.
Maybe both. And we'll actually score the target somehow this time.
Maybe something USPSA-ish, maybe not.
We'll do some kind. We need some kind of scoring to keep it
something.
Honest.
Yeah, something to balance the accuracy against the speed.
Yeah, I might just use like time plus or something. But whatever. There will be a scored target involved with pasters and crap like that.
Yeah.
The other thing, being the guy who, I think we kind of kicked this off because I had observed in class once. Hey, I felt kind of slow with my red dot. And then I put myself on the clock with some, like, draw, shoot, two drills. And my results were, no, you're actually faster with the red dot for most presentations. I think it's just, like, the weird, awkward ones that kind of throw me off. Or maybe it was a different concealment garment than I usually, like, a different style of draw or something. I don't know. Maybe I was just off that day. But that was the thing I noticed was that, for me personally, for the standard draw and presentation, I'm faster with the dot. I'm certainly no slower with the dot. But again, that's after a lot of work with one, and I'm pretty familiar with it and comfortable with it.
Yeah.
But
I think that's really the key thing here. The top end is obviously higher because open is a faster division than limited. And
yeah, ditto carry optics, actually.
Carry optics over production, and even limited. Yeah, it's then carry optics is just kind of production guns with red dots. So I guess you can have all those fancy
magazines.
Yeah, internal modifications. But still, the red dot is fast enough to make up for the magazine limitations.
It's non-major. It's non-major scoring, though.
But to make up for the non-major scoring, it's fast enough and accurate enough to beat limited that way.
Yep, because in limited, we know that by USPSA rules, in limited, major scoring beats minor scoring. And if you want to maximize your hit factor and your competitiveness, you're going to shoot limited with, you know, something in 40, so you make major. Right, so that disadvantage is obviated by, you know, more than obviated, because, you know, carry optics tends to be faster on the classifiers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's definitely some advantages to be had with slide mounted red dots.
Yeah,
and they're cool. So Jay, you think you're gonna find like some kind of mount to put one on a PX4?
Maybe. I think what I'm more likely to do is find some kind of rail mount to put it on the PO9 one of these times and shoot ghetto open.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, be like that guy. Hey, I'm gonna roll in with my shooting 40 and my 140 magazines because I can't find 170 extensions.
Yeah.
Anyway, that more or less wraps us up, I feel like.
I think so. Yeah, that covers everything we want to talk about today.
So it was a pretty gun-heavy night, which is always a good night.
Yeah. And hey, we were positive about red dots. We just, you know, weren't very positive about our ability to design experiments.
Yes. Well, we designed a good experiment. We just didn't carry it out very well.
Yeah. Exactly. Build implementation things.
Yeah.
And we're computer scientists. We don't know how to count.
Or do research, I suppose.
Yeah. Screw that.
That's not really our... I guess it kind of was... part of our field back at Rochester, but you weren't a computer scientist then, so you're just kind of back in the realm of pure math, pure knowledge.
Well, you know, I was always an applied guy there anyway, and I hated the research part, so...
Oh, well, there you go then, yeah.
See? Perfect.
Yeah, we never had a research methods class, so we...
Nope.
Yeah, but we will do better next time, we promise.
We'll make entirely new mistakes.
Exactly.
And then laugh at it here.
And on that bombshell...
Yeah, we're gonna end.
Yeah, well, I see I didn't pull up my outro script, so I'm just going to wing it. This has been the Crossbox Podcast, brought to you by my co-host John and me, Jay, and produced by Many Words Press. You can find us online at manywords.press. Our theme music is Royal Rumble by Jay Mann of ourmusicbox.com, and you can keep up with us, the Crossbox contributors, between podcasts at soapbox.manywords.press.